climate change, healthcare, and how Instagram is hurting our national parks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdal. It's May 29th, Memorial Day. Thanks so much for joining us. President Trump is back from his first overseas trip and has promised a decision this week about whether or not the United States will stick to the Paris climate deal, whether or not the U.S. will work with other countries to cut greenhouse gas emissions. At the end of the G7 summit over the weekend, the other members issued a statement reaffirming their, quote, strong commitment to swiftly implement the Paris Agreement. Marketplace's Andy Uhlert takes a look at what it'll mean if the U.S. decides to pull out, for diplomacy and for business.
The thing about Paris is that the deal isn't a treaty under U.S. law and didn't have to get approval from the Senate. Sue Benyes was lead State Department lawyer under President Obama and a key architect of the accord.
This one we deemed to be clearly within the realm of something that could be done as an executive agreement.
Which means President Trump can just take us out. But under the rules of the agreement, a country must stay put for at least the first 3 years, which would take us to 2019. She says the message could be damaging, though.
Even though the United States would continue to technically be a party for the next 3.5 years before the withdrawal takes effect, I think our influence would definitely decrease because countries would know we were not seriously staying engaged.
Trump used a report from the Heritage Foundation in a speech last month that says if we stay in the agreement, U.S. GDP could shrink by $2.5 trillion over a 10-year period. But many big names in corporate American culture, like Exxon and Apple, have said they think the U.S. should stay in. Elliot Derringer is with the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. He says what these businesses like about the Paris deal is that it gives them certainty and sets broad goals for reducing carbon emissions.
It doesn't specify you need to improve vehicle efficiency, you need to stop burning coal. It sets the long-term goals, which require very significant global reductions in emissions over time, and says the country is okay, tell us how you're going to meet that.
He says even though President Obama established the goal of reducing U.S. emissions by a quarter by 2025, if we pull out, it's unlikely the Trump administration will attempt to meet it. But if a new administration comes into office in 2020, the U.S. could immediately rejoin the accord. I'm Andy Uhler for Marketplace.
Congress is taking a break this week. When they return, the Senate will continue its work on a plan to replace Obamacare. Interest groups are trying to shape the law, lobbying, of course, but also spending millions of dollars on ad campaigns. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Ginzer checks it out.
If you're watching TV or surfing online in a swing congressional district, chances are you've seen this ad.
My family lost our insurance and doctor because of the Affordable Care Act.
And this one.
The new health care bill in Congress. If you're over 50, insurance companies can charge you 5 times more.
That first ad is paid for by the American Action Network. The second ad is from AARP.
These are ads that are considered issue ads.
That's Vivica Novak with the Center for Responsive Politics.
And they don't actually say vote for or vote against anybody.
The American Action Network is what the IRS calls a 501c4 group, which means it doesn't have to say where it gets its money or report right away how much it's spent. It didn't respond to my interview request. AARP did talk to me. John Hischta is senior vice president. He says AARP is spending in the 7 figures on its ad campaign.
We want to make sure that the senators hear from their voters back home when they go and do this debate moving forward.
Hischta says AARP is running ads in 4 states right now. Do the ads work?
Obviously, somebody must think they do or they wouldn't be doing them.
That's Steve Passwader, vice president and general manager at Kantar Media CMEG. He spoke to me via Skype. He says these kinds of issue ads from outside groups are becoming more common. In fact,
we are in the era of the perpetual campaign.
Passwader says the intense ad spending is fueled by a feeling that Republicans will eventually pass some kind of health care reform bill, and it will be signed by President Trump. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The markets had the day off for Memorial Day. Overseas markets, they were pretty quiet, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. Many of you likely took the long weekend to spend some time outside and then posted pictures of your excellent adventures on social media, hashtag amazing or whatever. Instagram and other social media can help steer people to photogenic places, but all the extra traffic has its downsides. Casey Schreiner is the founder and editor of the online magazine Modern Hiker. He came into the studio to talk about our love of those posed on a mountaintop selfies and the impact they're having on national parks and other public lands. Casey, thanks for being here.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So how has social media and Instagram changed the way people are experiencing the outdoors?
Well, it's changed it in a lot of ways. The phrase that you hear most often is that these parks and trails and public lands are being loved to death. Basically, they are the modern form of sort of publication and awareness. But a lot of times these parks are not equipped to deal with that onslaught of people
all
that come.
All that love.
Yes, with all that love. In this case, in some cases, too much love can be a bad thing. And another thing with Instagram and social media is the information that you're getting is not always the best. So we're getting new people into the parks, which is great. But a lot of times those new people aren't necessarily educated on, say, leave no trace ethics or how you act in the wilderness, you know, why you shouldn't walk on this certain type of soil or why you shouldn't take a rock or why you shouldn't, you know, maybe leave some graffiti on the trail if you've left.
So are they ruining it for the rest of us?
You know what? It's really difficult. I think at the end of the day, it's a net positive because you're getting people into these special landscapes and they're experiencing, in many cases, for the first time. So if you can get people out to these public lands and they can see what makes them special and what makes them magical, then you have the chance of turning even a small portion of those people into outdoor stewards. You know, those public lands live and die by the people who care about them. You know, speaking of the good side of social media, I've actually met and interviewed people who just started picking up trash on their own and documenting it on Instagram, and now they have this huge hiking group that goes out every weekend to these popular trails with giant trash bags and cleans them up. And that's a thing that, you know, would not have happened if social media wasn't around.
Are officials and sort of the folks in charge doing enough to help keep these places safe, keep them unvandalized, and keep the litter off? Are people going far enough to protect these spaces?
You know, a lot of times these places are severely underfunded. I think the national parks alone, not including national forests, monuments, or anything else, has something like a $5 billion backlog of, like, essential maintenance. This is, like, really, really hardcore stuff. Like, roads can fall apart, bridges can fall down. And it's been that way for a long time. This is not a new thing. This is a decades-long experience.
And I have to imagine the increase in visitors helped that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword because the increase in visitors increases the funds that people get from, you know, entry fees.
Right.
But it also increases the amount of use of the trails, obviously.
Right.
Last year, the National Park Service celebrated centennial. So they did a really big PR campaign. And I think the visitorship went up in pretty much every national park. I think Joshua Tree had last year it had 2.5 million visits, which was up over 500,000 from the previous year. Joshua Tree is unfortunately one of the parks that is really getting loved to death right now. Because it's so close to LA as a population center.
Are there best practices for Instagramming that beautiful view I see on my hike?
Yes, there are. And unfortunately, many people don't follow them, which is kind of disappointing. On Modern Hiker, we never give the geolocation of a post when we're posting it, because a lot of times that's sort of the laziest barrier of entry to finding out where to go. A lot of people see a photo, they click on the geotag, they find out where it is, they use Google Maps to get there. You're not getting any information about what that park is, why it's special, what the rules are, what the leave no trace principles are.
So is geotagging just something you turn that functionality off on that photo? Is it?
You don't necessarily have to turn it off, but what you can do is just not tag it.
Okay.
So there are instances where the geotagging is baked into the image itself. And in that case, if someone wanted to reverse engineer it, they could find out where it is. The casual Instagram user is not going to do that. We actually used that to find some National Parks vandals a couple years ago. The graffiti artist, Mr. Andre, we caught him vandalizing a Joshua tree using exactly that method. But when you're Instagramming, you have a choice of tagging a location. The same as if you're on Facebook, you can check yourself into, say, a building or a concert or a venue or whatever. And you can just choose to not tag it when you're tagging the image. So it just shows up as the image and it doesn't get a location. And then you have to read the small paragraph, which I know is like a big barrier for a lot of people, even like the four sentences you get on Instagram. But it's amazing when you read something, you actually learn something sometimes.
Casey Schreiner is founder and editor-in-chief of Modern Hiker. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hold up. It's time now for our Every Now and Again series, where we take your questions about the economy and try to find an answer. We call it I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Today's question is about making a living as an internet star.
My name is Carla Mosqueda from Stockton, California, and something that I've always wondered is how YouTubers make money.
We sent Marketplace's Robert Garova to find out.
Anna Akana is what you might call YouTube famous.
Cats, they're kitty babies, you're up there dead.
Not all of her videos are about cats. She has almost 2 million YouTube subscribers on her channel and covers stuff like dating advice and burnout at work.
I've been doing this for free for 5 years, so please let me now try to make a career off of it. And I've always found that people appreciate when you're honest about it instead of trying to sneakily sell them something.
Akana says she can spend thousands of dollars producing just one video. And even though she's found some stability now, it's still a struggle.
Internet fame is so short-lived that I'd hope any professional creator tries to think of diversifying their income. A lot of us are trying to get into the TV and film industry and finding a way to really sustain what we've created.
This is what YouTube calls its creator space in Los Angeles. There's pro cameras and sound equipment everywhere you look, a state-of-the-art screening room, too. Creators like Anna Akana can check in and use whatever they want for free. Today, there's a 360-degree music video shoot going on. Alvaro Bajos is head of YouTube Space LA. He says this place exists to churn out content.
We give them a path to grow. We get them excited about doing the next thing. We show our commitment to them, and we keep them engaged at the platform.
And in turn, YouTube has content to sell ads around. But those ads aren't as lucrative for creators as you might think. David Craig is a fellow at the Peabody Media Center and a professor at USC.
For the creators, they're making very little money from those ads. They used to make upwards of $20 to $25 per 1,000 views, but over time, that number has collapsed as the platform itself has grown in scale.
Now, Craig says, that number is more like $1 to $3 per 1,000 views, depending on the type of content. Laura Chernikoff is executive director of the Internet Creators Guild. That's a nonprofit that hopes to make the profession more sustainable for people making content on the internet.
Many creators will say they can't reliably live on the split from YouTube, and brand deals give them an opportunity to expand what they're able to do. Sometimes they even create content for the company's channel, not just their channel.
And it's those brand deals, not the ads, where the real money is. Here's Professor Craig again.
If an advertiser comes directly to you and pays you to promote their brand or product or service, you could on average, make between $75 to $100 per 1,000 views.
Which is a lot more than YouTube is shelling out on average. Anna Akana says the majority of her income is made from brand deals with companies like Squarespace and Audible. Professor Craig says brand deals are important, but it'd be wrong to say it's the only way creators make a living.
From virtual goods to fan funding to subscriptions on other platforms to e-commerce, live performances, book sales, music sales, film and TV performances, the list goes on and on.
And if that list of ways to make money on the internet makes you anxious, just think about creators like Anna Akana.
I think the scariest part of our jobs as digital creators is that it's completely brand new. This is new media. It's the Wild West. We don't know how long it's going to stay. And we really hope it does because it's a lot of people's jobs and it's how a lot of us make money.
To make things even more complicated, Twitter, Facebook, and Snapchat have all entered the space. So the brand a creator builds doesn't need to be tied to one platform anymore. I'm Robert Garova for Marketplace.
You've got questions? We have a series. What have you always wondered? For me, it's why so many parts of the country seem to have their own local potato chip brands. But that's beside the point. We want your questions. We're at marketplace.org. Coming up.
And so each one of the pieces that we put out into the market, it's almost like letting go of a child.
The child in this case is a cotton sweatshirt. American-made fashion, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Nothing doing on U.S. markets. They were closed today for Memorial Day. Traders got to sleep in, at least. In Europe, Britain's FTSE was also closed for a public holiday. So were markets in China. France's CAC 40 shed 0.1%, while Germany's DAX edged up 0.2%. In Asia, Japan's Nikkei barely changed. Pretty quiet all around. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrian Hill. About halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles, there's a tiny community that calls itself Oakeyville. Governor Jerry Brown declared an end to California's drought back in April. But in Oakeyville and in other parts of the state's Central Valley, there are still dry wells. Scientists say it could take decades to recover from depleted and mismanaged groundwater levels. Sarah Craig reports.
Son dos taquitos. ¿Tanto? ¿O también los cócteles?
When Maria Marquez's well went dry almost 3 years ago, she started organizing her neighbors who were also desperate for water. And she did so out of her taco truck.
Buenas tardes.
Marquez works through the hottest part of the day to deliver lunch to farm workers and truck drivers coming through town. When a customer from Oakeyville orders a torta asada, she takes the opportunity to tell him about the next community water meeting at her house. Marquez used to have a beautiful green yard. Today, it's brown and dusty. She doesn't even have enough water for her garden.
We used to plant cucumbers, tomatoes, tomatillos, chiles, watermelons. Now, we can't do any of that. We have to buy everything.
That takes its toll. Since Marquez can't grow her own vegetables, she has to spend more money on groceries and gas to get to the store. Lots of families have sold their farm animals because there's no water to give them. Oakeyville residents rank among the poorest in the state, when the median income is about $23,000 a year.
It makes life much more tenuous and immediate. It's a game changer.
That's Eric Coyne, a Tulare County official. He says the state and county pay for bottled water and household tank deliveries, which run about $400,000 a month. The district has seen rain this year, but it could take decades for the aquifer that feeds Oakeyville's wells to replenish.
So now people are spending what little money they have on water. Because without water, everything stops. You can't cook. You can't grow food.
There are about 100 homes in Oakeyville, and only 14 have water tanks. The state spends more than $7,000 per month to fill them. For houses without tanks, residents have made do by stringing hoses between houses and paying their neighbors. The going rate? About $50 a month. Jim Smith, an Oakeyville resident, lost his well and had to drill a new one for $28,000.
The drought is just people don't have the money to drill the wells, and that's the biggest problem.
The large-scale farms surrounding Oakeyville can afford this, but most farm workers can't. And because of the drought, there have been fewer crops to pick, which means fewer hours of work. A lot of families who could afford to walk away from their homes have left, but many can't do that or don't want to. Again, County Administrator Eric Coyne.
These become areas without an immediate livelihood. So they become places where they've lived for generations. They may have a house there that they inherited from the parents, and they paid literally nothing for it. And they can't afford to replace it.
Back in the taco truck, Marquez hands the torta asada to her customer. Her efforts to build support for a new community well have paid off. Oakeyville is getting one in October. But some people can't afford to wait that long and will have little option but to leave. Yes, without water, Marquez says, they can't do anything. In Oakeyville, I'm Sarah Craig for Marketplace.
likely than not, that t-shirt you're hanging out in today wasn't made in the U.S. Some companies are trying to change that, manufacturing clothes here. American Giant is one of them. The company makes t-shirts that'll run you $36. Hoodies that cost nearly $90, not cheap. They start with cotton grown here. North Carolina Public Radio's Leonita Inge has our story.
The head of American Giant, Byard Winthrop, is checking out the fabric at Carolina Cotton Works in Gaffney, South Carolina. This heavy cotton cloth for his line of hoodies and sweatpants has just been washed and dried and is ready to head to the cutters and sewers.
Maritime blue. So you can see it's a really dark, dark blue. And feel this. Feel this.
Winthrop has run several other business ventures, including those with products that were made mostly in China. He travels back and forth between North and South Carolina to check on various production elements for his American Giant line of clothing. His sources for cotton and yarn are domestic, and the company's dyeing and sewing work is also done in the U.S. Winthrop says this gives him a more hands-on view of his apparel business, so he can pay attention to the smallest detail.
I think we have taken maybe a different approach to new product in that we have a pretty narrow, pretty focused line.
That focused line means the company makes only casual cotton clothes in solid colors that are sold only online with a lifetime guarantee and a higher price tag than your average chain store t-shirts and sweatpants.
And so each one of the pieces that we put out into the market, it's almost like letting go of a child.
American Giant, started in 2011, seems to have embraced the rebirth of the Made in America movement at the right time. Trevor Little is an apparel technology management expert at North Carolina State University's College of Textiles. He has seen success come from the model American Giant is using.
American Giant's really smart because they're looking at the whole cost and then being able to make smaller quantities and deliver it quickly to the consumer.
Still, Little says the marketplace is very competitive. Most apparel sold in the U.S. is made overseas.
Amazon has now got its own line of products to compete with brands that are already on Amazon. And so the competition, the business competition side, is dynamic. It's always changing. Whatever that customer wants.
And on Amazon, you can find a wide variety of hoodies, some for $10 or $15. American Giant is betting that shoppers will continue to have a taste for its $89 classic full-zip cotton men's hoodie. Still, it wasn't a sure bet that American Giant could find a domestic company to sew its apparel. Brian Morrell is the general manager of Eagle Sportswear in Middlesex, North Carolina. Morrell says he didn't want to make the American Giant line at first. Too costly, too much needlework. He eventually changed his mind, but he continues to try and cut down on how much time it takes to make each hoodie.
We've increased efficiencies and changed some engineering, and we're down below in the 43-minute area now, but it's still a lot of time when you're looking at your regular hoodie that you would buy at a store.
The partnership has been good for Eagle Sportswear. The company's workforce has almost doubled since it started sewing American Giant apparel, from 98 to nearly 200 workers. In North Carolina, I'm Leonita Inge for Marketplace.
This final note before we go today, Ontario is planning on celebrating its 150th birthday with a giant yellow inflatable duck. The total cost of the duck's Ontario visit, including inflating it, is $200,000. That's an expensive duck. 90% of the cost is being covered with government grants. Officials tell the Ottawa Citizen they see the duck as an investment, hoping the giant version of the bathtub toy and the photo op potentials it presents will lure tourists. Duck Duck Ontario, maybe? I don't know. I got nothing. The markets were closed today for the Memorial Day holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrian Hill. Kai's back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.